Mourners in the occupied West Bank call for justice following the assassination of a senior member of the Palestinian resistance group by Israel. Iran criticizes the U.S. for making contradictory comments regarding negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. In China, Xi Jinping secures a historic third term as the country's leader for another 5 years. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News. Here in the Iranian capital, I'm your host, Behzad Shafiq. Good to have you with us. Palestinians have held a funeral for a resistance fighter who was assassinated by the Israeli regime early this morning. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes and called for justice. The victim, identified as Tamer Al-Kilani, was killed in a bomb explosion in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. He was a member of Erin al-Asud resistance group that's now warning of a harsh response. Hamas has also said that the crime will not go unanswered. The Islamic Jihad has reacted by saying that the assassination will only strengthen Palestinian resolve to fight on. Tensions have intensified in the occupied West Bank. On Saturday, Israeli soldiers shot and wounded a 16-year-old Palestinian in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Al-Quds, claiming he had injured an Israeli man in a stabbing attack. Iran has condemned contradictory comments by U.S. officials regarding negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 agreement. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says American authorities continue to exchange messages with Tehran, while at the same time they fanned the flames of anti-government riots in Iran. The top diplomat argued that U.S. officials are seeking to exert political pressure in order to win concessions during negotiations. The comments were an apparent response to statements by U.S. authorities who have announced that the JCPOA revival negotiations are no longer on Washington's agenda. Amir Abdullahian rejects that and says it's a priority for the Americans to reach an agreement, and they want that ASAP. The foreign minister stressed Iran will move within the framework of an agreement in which its red lines are respected. He added, however, that Iran won't leave the negotiating table. Now, we've asked peace activist Daniel Kovalik about the U.S.'s ultimate plan by pursuing a double standard policy toward Iran, and here's what he had to say.
Well, look, I would like to see the deal entered into again by the U.S., but I'll be honest, I don't predict that it will be. For the reason you say, the U.S. does not want deals with Iran. It wants regime change. And honestly, I think it's just going to continue to play games with Iran over the nuclear deal and other issues and do everything it can to overthrow the government. So what? Where is the incentive for Iran to negotiate here under those circumstances? I don't see it.
Now, President Ebrahim Raisi says that Iran is determined to win the sanctions war imposed by the U.S. and other adversaries, citing a 13% growth in non-oil exports this Iranian fiscal year. Raisi says that those who have enforced sanctions against Iran aim to prevent the country from achieving any growth or producing or exporting anything. He says that the U.S. Treasury Department has created numerous obstacles for Iranian exporters around the globe, as the enemies want Iran to be a mere consumer. Raisi stressed, however, that Iranian manufacturers and businessmen are determined to promote exports now that demand is rising for quality Iran-made products, including military hardware. He says this has angered Iran's enemies, who don't want the country to grow and capture markets. Russia says it's repelled an attack by the Ukrainian military to break through the border in the southern Kherson region, where it's evacuating civilians in anticipation of a counteroffensive.
In the Mykolaiv direction, the enemy attempt to breach the Russian troops' defenses by sending up to 2 battalion tactical groups on the west side of the Kherson region. All attacks were repulsed. The enemy was pushed back to their initial positions.
Konashenkov added that Ukraine's offensive aimed at a number of settlements on the west side of the Dnipro River. Russia has been under pressure in Kherson as it's bracing for a Ukrainian push to retake the region. Authorities there have urged residents to immediately leave the city. The command of Russian forces in Ukraine has described the military situation in those areas as tense and difficult. It says Ukrainian forces are deliberately targeting the infrastructure and residential buildings in Kherson. Since late August, Ukraine has recaptured hundreds of kilometers in its counterattacks. In the meantime, Kyiv says the Russian strikes on energy facilities have caused massive blackouts across Ukraine. The Ukrainian presidency says more than 1 million households are left without electricity. Some 670,000 of them are in western regions of Khmelnytsky alone. According to Ukraine's energy minister, Russian air attacks have hit at least half of Ukraine's thermal generation capacity since October 10th. 40% of the country's energy infrastructure has been seriously damaged. The chief of Ukraine's national energy operator says that some parts of the country are reducing their electricity use by up to 20%. Energy authorities believe that the voluntary measures aren't enough for the regions where the infrastructure has suffered the most damage. In Germany, tens of thousands of protesters have gathered to demand a more just distribution of government funds to deal with rising energy prices and living costs. The protests were held in six major cities, including capital Berlin. Ralliers held signs bearing slogans calling for lowering inflation and more energy price subsidies for the poor. And that after Parliament approved the government's 200 billion euro rescue package, which aims to protect companies and households from the impact of soaring energy prices. Some protesters are calling for a faster transition from fossil fuels and the switching off of nuclear power. German inflation in September hit its highest level in more than a quarter of a century, at nearly 11%, driven up by higher energy costs. Thus, thinking with Europe, Italy's first female prime minister, Giorgia Meloni, and her cabinet have been sworn in by President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni is tasked with steering her country out of an economic storm that risks damaging long-term family livelihoods. Max Civita reports from Rome.
On Saturday, 45-year-old Giorgia Meloni took an oath as Italy's prime minister before President Sergio Mattarella. Meloni, the country's first woman to become premier, is one of the founders and the current leader of the far-right-leaning party Brothers of Italy, the political force that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in last month's general election. Besides bringing some political stability to Italy, which has seen 68 governments in its 74 years of history as a republic, Meloni will have to face a series of daunting challenges, including a looming recession, protecting Italians from surging energy bills, and reassuring the establishment about her Atlanticist and anti-Putin alignment. Italy's new Prime Minister, Giorgia Meloni, says her government will follow the line of NATO and the Western Alliance. Also, the new Foreign Minister, former European Parliament President Antonio Tajani, has repeatedly said he will be fully supportive of Kyiv. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Earlier this week, a video portraying Berlusconi saying that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky should be held accountable for the conflict in Ukraine caused a stir in the political arena. Italians are hoping the new government will work for a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Ukraine. Meloni is expected to lay out her political priorities next week when she faces confidence votes at the parliament that will confirm or not that she holds a majority. Max Civili, Rome.
It's news review time. Now, Xi Jinping will be the leader of China for another 5 years, and that after Communist Congress Party confirms his status. President Xi was picked as the party's general secretary for a third term in a closed-door vote, and that means he'll be elected president at the annual meeting of National People's Congress in March. The new lineup of the party's seven-member standing committee, over which Xi presides, was also announced. Speaking to media at the event, President Xi said that China has opened its doors to the world for better interaction. He said that the country is on the path to modernization and will move towards securing better prosperity for its people. During its week-long gathering, the Congress approved the addition of new wording to the party charter, elevating Xi's core status. Now allow me to invite a couple of guests to discuss this a bit. So John Ross is a senior fellow with the Chang'an Institute at the Renmin University of China. He's joining me from London. Also on the phone, I'll be joined by Manuel Pasrash, who's president of Asia Institute in Beijing. So let's begin with London. John, good to have you with us. So let's take a look at the domestic issues that President Xi will be facing in his new term in office.
Hello, you're asking me or you're showing something?
Yeah, John, go ahead. Did you hear my question?
Oh, sorry, okay. Well, the most fundamental problems that he fronts are outside the country. I mean, inside China, things are going well at the moment. It's got the fastest growth of any major economy in the world. All economies have slowed down, so China's slowed down, but it's still growing three times as fast as the US. They've avoided any serious number of deaths from COVID. There's only just over 5,000 deaths in mainland China compared to over a million in the United States. So within China, things are going rather well. The problem is outside. Firstly, is the big problems which exist in the global economy due to the inflation in the United States. The United States says global inflation is due to the Ukraine war, but this is just untrue. 90% of US inflation took place before the Ukraine war started. And therefore, it's the policies of the US government which have created this inflation, but it's having a bad effect in the rest of the world. So there's the objective problems created by the US. And then secondly, the United States is trying to pursue a policy of trying to hold China down by technology boycotts and other things, which creates some problems for China. So basically, I would say the situation is inside China, things are going really very well. And the problems that President Xi faces are constituted by the external problems outside China.
Okay, now let me ask Emmanuel on the phone. Emmanuel, Xi Jinping has secured a historic third term as China's leader, as you know. Now, let's take a look at his performance. How has he impacted or, let's say, changed China's standing in the world?
Well, he has been quite predictable. He's followed basically the policy that he put out from the beginning of his first term. He's created a stable political and economic environment. He has encouraged long-term planning and long-term implementation. He has promoted science, which now, I mean, it's not entirely his creation, but China has now become a leader in science in a way, decisive way, that it was not the case before. And overall, his decision to focus on alleviating poverty and creating greater equality in the economy, although difficult, maybe not totally successful, is still far better than policies in other countries. And overall, China is one of the few countries in the world capable of long-term planning and long-term implementation of policy.
Okay, back to London. John, Beijing has forced closer ties with Russia and Iran, and that's despite the U.S. opposition. So, John, how do you think this policy is affecting global equations and developments?
Well, it's creating problems for the fact that the United States is trying to unilaterally impose its policies on the world. The number of countries which have got sanctions against them because of the United States is growing, not by the United Nations. There's an agreed framework. The only body which can approve internationally sanctions is the UN Security Council. The US is acting more and more outside of it, that in a unilateral fashion economically. So it's trying to impose its diktats upon the world. And the United States is becoming more aggressive militarily. I mean, if you look against developing countries, there was the bombing of Serbia in 1999, the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the bombing of Libya in 2011, intervention in Syria continuously since then. And now the United States has been prepared to provoke a war in Ukraine by the attempt to expand NATO into Ukraine, which has created a confrontation with a nuclear-armed state. So the United States is pursuing not merely an aggressive course, but a unilateral course, and more of the world is not prepared to put up with it. As you can see, for example, with the countries which have imposed sanctions against Russia, more than countries representing more than 80% of the world's population have refused to go along with US policy, but the US is continuing it. So basically, the agreement of China and the other countries has prevented these unilateral diktats by the United States. And this is very much in the interest of the world's people.
Okay. And Emmanuel, you talked about what Xi Jinping has done so far in his past performance. Now, what about the future? What's future holding for China under his leadership?
Well, I think that continuously the issue of social inequality will be critical for his domestic agenda. And there was an emphasis in the recent documents released from the Assembly that emphasized socialist economic policy. So that is a shift which I think we'll continue to see. We see a move towards a greater role for China globally, a greater ethnic diversity. There was an effort in the events surrounding his reappointment in the Assembly to emphasize the diversity of China, the different ethnic groups. And I think that was intended to show that China is diverse and it embraces a multi-ethnic, diverse global order as well. And that was, although he didn't say it quite as explicitly as, say, President Putin did, it was certainly very clear that there was effort. There will be an effort in the future to offer a very obvious, clear alternative to the unilateral Western European and American global vision that, unfortunately, the United States is increasingly pursuing.
Okay, John, same question to you. In what direction will China be moving in the future under the leadership of Xi Jinping?
It'll continue to what it's been over the last period, which is it's the world's most rapidly growing major economy. The living standards of the Chinese population will continue to increase. The elimination of poverty, which is absolute poverty, has been eliminated, but obviously there are still pockets of relative poverty within China. This will all continue. That's what it's been doing for the last decades. And as President Xi's policies have been implemented for 10 years, we know that these are going to continue. Then internationally, China is not seeking a confrontation with anybody. China would prefer that the United States didn't pursue these aggressive and provocative policies. China would like to get on with peaceful development.
Okay, I appreciate your comments and insight. John Ross in London, Emmanuel Pasraich in Beijing. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Tell about yourself.
Ameri Kshmanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special, on this beautiful Sunday, October 23rd, 2022. I'm Atefe Erfani hosting this program today. Listeners, a special, as you know, is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Please do remember, listeners, the special, the Sunday program is your program. It's your views that are important. Please don't go away and keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special Day Sunday program, your program. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. You know why? Because these reception reports enable us to have a better service to our listeners around the world. And all of you who sent in a reception report will be receiving an electronic QSL from us. And here I truly send my warm gratitudes and appreciations to those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Victor Varzin from Russia, Federico Correa from Italy, and Marek Peace from Poland. So Victor, Federico, and Marek, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to your radio station, IRIB English Radio. And of course, we've received many emails and letters from around the world, which I mentioned some of their names here. And later during the program, I will read these, of course, great emails. From Austria, we've received an email from Joan Hachol. From Japan, we've received an email from Hitoshi Sugio. Owen Williams from England has sent us an email. Artur Fernandez Lorella, one of our old and regular listeners from Spain, has sent us an email. And the last but not the least is an email from one of our old and regular listeners, Tio from Manila, Philippines. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. As I said, from Austria, we've received an email from John Hutchell. I wish I'm right in pronouncing your name, John. Anyway, let's see what he says. Dear IRIB English Radio, this is a reception report from Austria. There is some fading, but in general, all the transmission is well received, given a modern receiver. I would appreciate to receive an electronic QSL card. I appreciate the diversity and, as such, your English news service at times and in respect to certain topics, a valuable contribution to a different view. All the best. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. John Hachel from Austria. We appreciate your email. And my colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL as verification, Joan from Austria. So, you enjoy the diversity of the programs, thank God, as well as the new section, it seems you liked it. Thank you for letting us know about that. Anyway, Joan Hutchell from Australia, we wish you all the best, and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And from Japan, we've received an email from Hitoshi Sugio. Hitoshi Sugio says, I listened to your English program at home. Signal was very weak, and I had difficulty to understand the programs. I hope this reception report will be helpful for your technicians. If you confirm the details of my report is correct, I request you to send me your verification card or letter to my address in Japan or by email. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Hitoshi Sugio, and many thanks for this email. You seem to be a new listener, Hitoshi Sugio from Japan, and it's a pleasure for us. So, you listened to IRIB English radio programs at home, and that's great. And unfortunately, you found the signal weak. But Hitoshi Sugio from Japan, be sure that our technicians and engineers will fix the problem very soon. For the time being, accept our electronic QSL as verification. Hitoshi Sugio from Japan, write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. We wish you all the best, Hitoshi Sugio from Japan. And after a short break, I will be back with you. This is Listeners Special, and I am reading your great emails, dear listeners. So, from England here, we've received an email from Owen Williams. Let's see what Owen says. I am listening to your service from Bristol, England. I am listening using a portable receiver and just the attached short whip antenna. Considering this, the signal is very reasonable. There is a lot of local electrical noise at my location, but despite this, the broadcast is totally readable. I have attached a short audio clip of what I have received. I would be very grateful if you could send me an EQSL card to verify my reception report. I wish you all the best and hope to hear from you in the future. Take care and 73s. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Owen Williams from England, and please accept our warm gratitude to you for sending us this email. We're so glad that you were successful in receiving the signals of IRIB English Radio in your region in Bristol, England. And it seems that you enjoyed the quality of the signal as you found it reasonable and, of course, readable. Thank God. Anyway, we received your audio clip. Thank you for that. We wish you all the best. And we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Owen Williams from England. And from Spain, one of our old and regular listeners called Arthur Fernandez Lorella has sent us a piece of email. Let's see what Arthur Fernandez Lorella says. Dear friends, it would be so kind of you to send me QSL card again in a short time. That is very nice of you. I hope to get it very soon. Let me wish you a nice day, and I am sending you my warm greetings from Catalonia in Spain, waiting for a reply from your side. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and on behalf of all IRIB English radio staff, to you, Arthur Fernandez Lorella from Spain. We're so happy that our signals are received in Catalonia in Spain. Thank you for this email, Arthur. And of course, we will send you an electronic QSL as a verification very, very soon. We wish you all the best. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English radio programs. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. Tio from Manila, the Philippines, has sent us an email. For your information, Tio is one of our OLAN regular listeners. Let's see what Tio says. Dear IRIB, I am Aaron Tio from Manila, the Philippines. I am enclosing the details of shortwave radio reception for IRIB English Radio. When I tuned into your radio, I heard some Persian music, I presumed, which I liked so much. I hope that my reception report would be acknowledged with a QSL verification card. Salam and greetings to you, Tio, from Manila, the Philippines, one of our old and regular listeners. Tio, please accept our warm appreciations to you for this email. Thank God you enjoyed the music. It must be a piece of Iranian traditional music, as we always broadcast. Tio from Manila, the Philippines, thank you for letting us know your attitudes toward IRIB English radio programs. It's a pleasure. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Tio from Manila, thank you again. Well, as they say, art is long, but time is short. So before wrapping up this edition of Listeners Special, again, I thank all those our great listeners who kindly sent us emails and letters from around the world, as well as reception reports, including Owen Williams from England, John Hutchell from Austria, Hitoshi Sugio from Japan, Arthur Fernandez Lorella from Spain, Tio from Manila, the Philippines, Victor Verzin from Russia, Federico Caria from Italy, and Marek Peace from Poland. Many thanks for being with us. Please keep in touch with Listeners Special and your favorite radio station, IRIB English Radio. Have a good time and goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
UK's political drama is nothing short than a soap opera. A country that will have five prime ministers in 5 years, one that has also had four finance ministers or chancellors of the exchequer just this year. Why is there so many resignations and uncertainty in that country, especially at a time when the UK is dealing with the cost of living crisis? In this edition of The Spotlight, we'll look at where the UK is headed to and whether it can climb out of this political deadlock. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Political economy researcher and analyst Clive Menzies joins us from London. Also joining us is journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, who joins us from Belfast.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'll first start with you, Clive Menzies, and ask you about basically what are we looking at when it comes to the UK? I mean, you know, I mentioned the stat, five prime ministers in 5 years, and you have four finance ministers or chancellors of the exchequers that have come and gone just this year. What does this say about the UK?
Well, I think what it says about the UK is something more general, which is to do with who is actually driving what is happening in the UK and elsewhere. And essentially, if you look at the machinations over the last few months, we've been predicting an economic collapse, a global economic collapse for some years now. And we were anticipating that October was going to be quite a critical month. And I think that Liz Truss's appointment was something of a hospital pass insofar as she was destined to fail in terms of trying to cope with the situation. And furthermore, anyone else who takes that position will be similarly afflicted by the bigger picture, which is essentially driven by the money markets and money power. And so whoever they put in place is similarly going to be facing huge difficulties because there is no fiscal or monetary ammunition left in the armory to deal with what is taking place. They've already created huge amounts of money printing. The banking system in the UK, Europe, and in the USA, and governments are being discredited because they have been complicit in this fiasco that has brought us to this position.
When you take a look at the country on the economic front, that is one thing for our Hughes, but when you take a look at the turnover, as they say, I mean, that's quite astonishing. And when Liz Truss resigned, it just days ago, she was in Parliament saying, I'm a fighter. It just seemed so abrupt. What do you think might lead to her resigning in the form and manner that she did, given the short period of time that she was in that position?
I'm not sure she was given an awful lot of choice. I believe it's the 1922 committee that carries a lot of weight and a lot of influence within the parliamentary party of the Conservatives. And I think just with her, with the budget that she brought in and the flight of finance from the UK and the strengthening of the dollar and the weakening of the pound, I think that the people who have the influence in the background just told her it was time to go. I don't think she had much of a choice. You know, under the circumstances, she might have been able to call for a vote of confidence in her leadership, but I'm sure that the sounding she took in the background among her own MPs and close party colleagues would have told her that that support wasn't there. I mean, she threw her chancellor, her choice, underneath the bus in order to try and save herself and save her skin. But it wasn't enough. It was too little, too late. And I think we're witnessing like a car crash politics. You know, it's a circus now where they're just, you're waiting for the music to start and everyone to play past the parcel. And, you know, the last one to sit down becomes the next prime minister.
You've caught my attention there, Clive Menzies, when you say that decisions are being made from not within or from the outside, in a sense, as if I heard you correctly. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because, for example, when it came to Hunt receiving word that Liz Truss was actually wanting him to take over the job as the Exchequer, he thought that it was a joke, that it was not even something that was authentic.
Well, I think it was fair to say that if you look at the background of her appointment, there was a fair amount of, shall we say, hedge fund money that was interested in her appointment, and they profited highly out of what she did. The collapse of the pound they made money out of. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily the case that these things happen of her own volition. If you look back, all of any prime minister who resigns always to the last minute says that they're fighting and they will stay on until they're eventually ejected. And I think that the forces that are at work are much clearer today than they may have been in the past. And money is, the banking system and those that control money are very much in control of the agenda overall. But I would say that no one is driving the bus now. It is just the collapse. Your other guest referred to a car crash. I see it more as a slow motion train crash that started in the financial crisis of 2008. And it is now accelerating and nobody is in control of this bus. And the politicians, to some extent, are the fall guys in this episode because they will be blamed. But it is actually a structural problem which is far deeper than politics can cope with.
Well, you have a party by the name of the Conservative Friends of Israel, Frau Hughes. And it was interesting when she was running for the premiership, she made a vow, or a pledge, I should say, that not only would she, during one of those conferences that was held by the CFI, that she would definitely reevaluate first, she said, on moving the UK embassy from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds, and then to review the trade deal between the UK and Israel, of which it was up for reevaluation. She said, you know, we can do much better trade and much more trade and an expanded amount of trade of volume with Israel. And she, when she got elected, she was moving on that track, which was quite interesting for that to be on top of her list. And some deducted that she had made pledges to some of the wealthy within Israel that, hey, come invest in our country, improve our economy. And, of course, we know that she was really holding the trickle-down economics at the center of that piece. But that didn't guarantee her her staying on. What do you think went wrong there? This will be for... I'm sorry, Frahis. Frahis, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much. Yes. No, I think it's just... I think it's a case of what your other contributors said. It's the money in the background. You know, there should be some type... I know there is supposedly a cap on how much you spent in elections, and there has to be tax returns in order to make you give everyone an even chance of being elected. But I think there's definitely an Israeli lobby. There's definitely money involved in the corruption of politics, if I could use that particular phrase. And I think what we have is her pledge to Israel was, I am a true friend of Israel, just like Donald Trump declared before he became elected the president in the United States. And Barack Obama, before that, he went to the Wailing Wall and put on the prayer cap and the prayer shawl and almost gave deference to Israel over the over his own American constitution. So I think I think they helped get her elected. There will obviously be friends of Israel within the Conservative Party. They probably would have garnered all those votes to help get her elected. But let's just say now that she's gone and it looks like Rishi Sunak is probably the most likely person to be not elected, but to be chosen to replace her by the Conservative Parliamentary Party. He is the man that the elected MPs want to lead the party. And Boris Johnson may be the man who the Conservative membership would like to elect. But I read there recently that there were questions raised about Rishi Sunak's wife's connection with InfoSystems, whose headquarters, I believe, are in Israel, and they have close connections to the Israeli intelligence service. So you might have a change of prime minister, but unfortunately you will not have a change of policy when it comes to defending Israel, and God forbid that he might continue with her plans to move the embassy to Al-Quds.
Sure. Clive Menzies, so what are your thoughts on this Conservative Party's future? I mean, at this point, you would think that, you know, they have had this grip on power, and they were able to do that by learning, obviously, all their mistakes through their leadership throughout the years. But that didn't transpire the way it has. Do you think that the future of the party is in jeopardy? That's something people are saying, and I'm not too sure what that quite means. First of all, if you agree with it, and what does that exactly mean?
Well, I think there's a wider question about the discrediting of national politics. I think one's seeing it in America as well as in the UK and in Europe too, that actually the caliber of politician has been slowly declining in terms of their intellectual ability. Not that I think that anything has changed significantly, other than there appears to be an overall plan, because if you look at this in the context of the Great Reset, where there are plans to create a one-world government, one of the essential prerequisites of that is to destroy the identity of the nation-state, and part of that is to discredit politics. I think there are a number of possibilities that lie ahead, either that another patsy or pigeon will be parachuted into place and they will be similarly discredited in a fairly short space of time. Or we could actually see a national government being formed. But let's not forget that Keir Starmer is a member of the Trilateral Commission. And referring to the power that, or sway that Israel has over British politics, that applies to both parties. And I think you're at it. Other guests was spot on, that irrespective of the flavour of the rhetoric or the flavour of politics that appears superficially or cosmetically, the agenda continues irrespective. And most of what we're seeing is theatre, and the real agenda continues almost unabated.
Well, there's got to be at some point some kind of, I'm sure, voting that needs to take place, not within the party to choose the next leader, but a democratic vote that needs to take place. At this point, Fahiz, don't you think that people there in the UK have lost trust in, I don't want to say democracy, but in the system of governance in order for them to come out and vote for one party or the other?
Well, speaking personally, I no longer vote. I believe that by voting these people in, we do give them a mandate. But, you know, when they're in opposition, they are populist and they say what people want to hear and also claim to bring in policies that people need in order to, you know, fight against the rising cost of living and the energy hikes, et cetera, et cetera. But once they get into power, they universally seem to just let us down and continue with the same poker game that we're witnessing at the minute. So should people have a general election? Absolutely. But the Tories aren't going to hold one because they know they will be decimated if they go in front of the electorate. It is not just the debacle of the economy. I mean, anyone in their right mind is not in favour of this war continuing in Ukraine. And when people like Boris Johnson and then Liz Truss get up in the House of Commons, and Boris actually went on more than one occasion, I believe, to Kiev to show his solidarity and support, they're encouraging a continuation of a war that it appears that Ukraine cannot win. So they're just wasting human lives, civilian and military, for the sake of, some people are saying, the midterm elections in America. So the Tories won't have an election. And even if there was one, even if the people demanded one, and they then changed the Tory parties for Keir Starmer's Labour Party, it's new Labour, and I don't see any real difference between them and the incumbent Conservative Party in power at the minute. And Keir Starmer, was actually the man who prosecuted Julian Assange. So if there's no justice for Julian Assange, there'll be no justice for the people of the United Kingdom if Keir Starmer is elected.
Yeah, indeed. That's a fact that many forget. So, Clive Menzies, if we want to take a look at what has occurred regarding this post, the Prime Minister post. I mean, as I mentioned, you got three leaders that sought to basically get the Brexit done. Of course, what happened with Cameron and what he called for, the vote for that. And, you know, they have not been able to do it. Is it the fact that the problem lied in Brexit itself, that should not have happened? Or is it the fact that the leaders could not get Brexit done?
Well, I think Brexit is something of an illusion, because whilst all the things that inconvenience ordinary people, travel and freedom to do business in Europe and all of those things, Brexit is an illusion. There has been no exit. Militarily, we're more closely tied in with Europe, legally, financially, and almost in every respect that matters. We are tied into Europe and still following European directives, even though they may not be acknowledged as such. So I think Brexit, if you go back to 2016, there was when the vote happened, there was growing realization that the major problem was the power of money. And it was very definitely the 99% against the 1%, or in fact, I would argue much smaller than 1%. And what both the election of Trump in 2016 and the Brexit vote did was split the 99% down the middle. And that has been a trick that has been played for centuries, that you divide the electorate, in order to carry on with the agenda that has been in place. And if we look at the prospective candidates, Rishi Sunak, for example, not only is he tied into Israel, but he, like a number of other leading conservatives from past administrations, are very much tied into the banking system. And the banking system is not comprised of individual banks and central banks. They're all controlled by the same few families. And so this is, as I said earlier, this is the theatre that goes on. Brexit is similarly theatre, because there has never been an intention to provide true autonomy or independence. And if we're not following EU directives, we're following UN directives. There is an overarching agenda to concentrate power effectively in a one-world government. And the EU was merely a conduit for that. And whether they do it via national governments directly or whether they do it via regional accumulation such as the EU is not really important. The agenda continues irrespective. But the good news is that it's becoming very apparent that the wheels are falling off the bus, and there are a growing number of people who are disaffected with politics, they're disaffected with the system.